where we got to yesterday. We were discussing the Unruh effect. What's happening? And so the idea was to do the coordinate transformation to go to an accelerated frame of reference. So in the same way Lorentz transformation tells you how to map between inertial frames, one observer moving at some constant velocity to another, here we did the coordinate transformation that went to an accelerated frame, and the appropriate coordinate map. So if we started with the original Minkowski space, I think call it t squared plus x squared, and then we defined capital light cone coordinates t plus or minus x, so that this was minus dx plus dx minus, then the transformation that did the job was x plus or minus is plus or minus 1 over a e to the a little x plus or minus. So this mapped into e to the a x plus, and there was a plus or minus there, minus x minus d little x plus or minus, and then defining little x plus or minus was tau plus or minus rho, so analogous time and space coordinates to these ones, then this metric is equivalent to e to the 2 a rho minus d tau squared plus d rho squared, and then further defining, if we want to, r is 1 over a e to the a rho. Then this metric is the same as dr squared plus a squared r squared, sorry, minus a squared r squared d tau squared, and that's the definition of Rindler space, or equivalently this one. And so to draw that, what that actually means on the space-time diagram, if this was your original time and space coordinates, what we were doing is setting up a coordinate system. Sorry, should do better than that. Setting up a coordinate system so that every point of constant rho, every using the space coordinate here, a line of constant rho corresponds to an accelerated observer in the original Minkowski coordinate system. So these are the lines of constant rho. And as we demonstrated, because the equation for an accelerated observer goes like x is 1 over a square root of 1 plus a t squared, then all accelerated observers asymptote to light rays, as t goes to plus infinity, they will approach the speed of light. As t goes to minus infinity, they will approach the speed of light. And the physical implication of that is that this light ray is a future event horizon, because no matter how fast you try and send a signal from someone over here, you can never go faster than the speed of light. And so you can never send a signal that will communicate with this accelerated observer. And similarly, that's a past event horizon. And it's the existence of this event horizon that is going to be the essential feature in the Unruh effect. And this event horizon in these coordinates lies at, so this one, let me try and get this right. So this is the line x is t. So that's the same as x minus is 0. And this is the line x is minus t. So that's the same as x plus is 0. Okay, and so, and I ended with just the standard wishy-washy argument that if you take that metric and you Euclideanize it, so you do tau goes to I tau Euclidean, then it's just the spherical, it's the metric of flat space in polar coordinates, provided that we identify tau e goes to tau e plus 2 pi over a plus 2 pi over a. And that's just the standard fact that you have to, the angles have to add up to 2 pi as you integrate around a circle. So any function which is regular when you Wick rotate it to the Euclidean space, if the function is smooth in the Euclidean space, it must be periodic with period 2 pi over a. And by the standard argument, that's associated with a temperature. But now let's actually do the calculation that shows that that's really the case. So we've been working in two dimensions because just because it's simple, nothing really we've said so far couldn't be easily extended to higher dimensions. But in order to make the following calculations simple, I'm now going to concentrate on a massless scalar in two dimensions. So let's consider a theory of a massless scalar in two dimensions. Now, this really is somewhat of an oversimplification that I'm going to do only because if I didn't do this, I wouldn't be able to solve anything. So the action for a massless scalar, let me write it properly in the original coordinates in TdX, would look like something like this. Or let me write it covariantly. In general, there'd be some metric here, root minus g, and then we have that. Now, the reason I'm concentrating on a massless scalar in two dimensions is it has an accidental symmetry that makes life very easy. Namely, a massless scalar in two dimensions is conformally invariant. So what that means is if I take the scalar living on some space G, which is on some space, and then let's do a conformal transformation, G is omega F. So I define a new metric, F, which is conformally related to G. Then under that transformation, the determinant of the metric, so the determinant of a 2 by 2 matrix is going to go like, is going to go like omega squared times the determinant of the new metric F. That's just because it's two, if we're in D dimensions, that would go like D. So in two dimensions, that's 2. So the special feature of two dimensions is that the combination root minus g times g upstairs ab goes to, under the conformal transformation, root minus f times f upstairs ab. And that's because if the metric transforms like that, the inverse of the metric has to transform like the inverse. So the omega squared from here precisely cancels the omega squared from there. And as you see, that's in a complete accident of two dimensions. It's only because d is 2 here. And of course, that's the same conformal invariance you have in string theory, which is why when you strings have conformal fields, and is used there. And so we're just going to use this here for simplicity. The reason we're using it is because our original Minkowski coordinates here, t and x, were precisely conformally related to these new coordinates, tau and rho. Now remember, physically, tau basically represents the proper time. So for rho equals 0, tau is the proper time along the accelerated trajectory. It's counting the proper time along this trajectory because this trajectory is the surface. Every one of those trajectories is at constant rho. So up to a multiplicative factor, which is constant, this tau here precisely counts the proper time along the trajectory. And that's why we went to that coordinate system. So just because of this conformal invariance, without doing any effort whatsoever, I know immediately that if I wrote the action in the new coordinates, it would look like integral d tau d rho of a half d phi d tau squared minus a half d phi d rho squared. In other words, it looks absolutely identical in the new coordinates as it did in the old coordinates. So that makes it very easy to solve. If I was in the original coordinates, the original Minkowski coordinates, and I quantized that scalar field, what would I do? Well, I would just do the standard procedure now. You've seen lots of times, so I would split it integration annihilation operators. Sorry, I'm so used to doing that in three dimensions. So in one dimension, instead of d3k, we just have 1k normalized with respect to 2 pi. And then we have our creation operator ak. This integral is from minus infinity to plus infinity over all k. We have a creation operator ak times e to the ikx. And then we have our positive frequency modes, which will be normalized as usual, 1 over two, square root of 2 times mod k, e to the I mod k t. And it's just here the frequency omega is just mod k because there's no mass. It's a massless field. And then you have the complex conjugate of that. And I'm quantizing this field because these are creation annihilation operators which satisfy the one-dimensional K1, K2, the one-dimensional creation annihilation operator algebra that looks something like that. So that's the standard thing. That's what a Minkowski space observer would choose to do. But the accelerated observer, he's using these times in this distance because that's his proper time. That's what he measures with his clock. And that's the natural distance that he uses. So he's going to split the same field. He's going to make that a function of tau and rho, and he's going to go through the same thing. So I use a different variable kappa to represent his momentum, just not to confuse it with that thing. And he's going to use some creation annihilation operators. Kappa tau, sorry, that's a rho. Plus bk dago, 1 over square root of 2 mod kappa, e to the plus I kappa tau. E to the minus I kappa rho. So exactly the same formula. I've just written it with different things. So the Minkowski observer, he chooses his vacuum to be the Lorentz invariant vacuum, which, as we've shown in the three-dimensional case and just works as well here, 3 plus 1-dimensional case, is the vacuum defined by AK is 0. So let me call that the Minkowski vacuum, or M. So remember, the virtue of that vacuum is that, so defined, a two-point function using that vacuum, 5x, 5y, is Lorentz invariant, which means it's only a function of the combination x minus y squared, which is iterate b xa minus ya xb minus yb. That's the definition of the Lorentz invariant vacuum. But the accelerated observer, he measures time with this time here. And so his natural choice of vacuum is going to be the one annihilated by, sorry, I should have put a different label on, by these operators. So he will define what we call the Rindler vacuum, which are the ones that are naturally operated by the annihilated by the annihilation operator, naturally associated with modes which are positive frequency with respect to the time of an accelerated observer. And the key point is that these two things are not the same. So this really sort of encodes the observer dependence of the vacuum. Every observer, the natural vacuum that they use, is the one defined by using positive and negative frequency modes with respect to their proper time, the proper time of that observer, and that's what we're doing here. So tau here is really the proper time of the accelerated observer, whereas the real, in some sense, the real vacuum has to be defined globally, and there you use the best thing you can do, which is the time associated with the killing vector in the space-time, the globally defined time-like killing vector, and that's the Minkowski vacuum. So the fact that the accelerated observer sees particles when in the vacuum is precisely because a positive frequency mode defined globally is going to be a superposition of positive and negative frequency modes positive and negative frequency modes in the accelerated frame. So precisely how we make that superposition, we have to do it in such a way that we preserve the norm of wave functions, so it has to correspond to a Bogoliubov transform along the mode function, along for the properly normalized mode functions. So the properly normalized mode functions are always with the root 2 mod kn. So what we're going to do is look for relationship whereby this mode function with the root 2k is going to be expressible as some Bogoliubov transform which will depend on the original k and on the new value of kappa multiplied by the properly normalized positive frequency mode here, which is 1 over root 2 mod kappa e to the I mod kappa tau plus beta k kappa 1 over root 2 mod kappa e to the plus I mod kappa tau. And then we have to integrate over all kappa, because there's no reason, in general, for the bit to be a one-to-one correspondence. I think that's right. Yeah, there's no reason for there to be a one-to-one correspondence between this k and this kappa. So we're expressing properly normalized positive frequency modes in the global coordinate system as a Bogoliubov transform of positive and negative frequency, properly normalized positive frequency nodes in the accelerated frame of reference. And this is one of those more general types of Bogoliubov transform. Not the ones, so we've been playing around where you've just got one which is a function of k, but if you remember when we originally introduced them, this was just a special case of a more general transform which could depend on two momenta, and then we just concentrated on cases where that happened to be proportional to a delta function. But in this case, because there's no straightforward relationship between the momenta, the global momenta, and the momenta defined in the accelerating frame of reference, we have to take into account that the Bogoliubov transformations can really depend on both momenta differently, and they don't have to be equal to a delta function. Yep. Yes.
But I think I saw that it can be also the vacuum which minimizes the energy. So if you write the right Hamilton, so
that's right.
What is
So we discussed that before. So I mean, there were different possibilities to choose a vacuum. If you have a symmetry, then that's a natural thing to pick out the vacuum. But if you have a globally defined time-like Killing vector, then also that means you've got a conserved energy, and the minimum energy is also the vacuum, and it gives the same answer here. In some sense, that was inevitable, because if there is a minimum, it has to be a special preferred point, and the special point is always going to be where the symmetry is true. So as well as being Lorentz invariant, this is also the minimum energy state. But that's special only to spacetimes that have a globally defined time-like Killing vector. So in the case of de Sitter, which we'll get to in a bit, there is a symmetry which is the same. There's a de Sitter symmetry, but there's no globally defined time-like Killing vector. So the de Sitter vacuum is not the minimum of any energy. It's not a minimum energy state. Okay, so what we want to do is find these coefficients, and this is just a little bit of tricky maths now. To do that, and essentially the trick is I've gone and done my usual thing of forgetting the spatial dependence. I should have put it in. So that's the modes with the full spatial dependence. So just for simplicity, so because we've got a distinction between k's and mod k's here, let's just first focus on the case where k is positive, so k equals mod k, and similarly where kappa is positive. Kappa is mod kappa. And you can go through each case and do it separately. This is just to make my life easy. So then in that case, this formula, I can drop the mods. This is e to the plus ik x minus t is some superposition of 1 over root 2 kappa e to the, let me write that as minus I kappa tau minus rho plus 1 over root 2 kappa beta k kappa e to the plus I kappa tau minus rho. And this is actually the definition. So t minus x is, of course, the definition of capital X minus. So this is the same as this statement. And now the integral only goes over the positive values of kappa. And that's little x minus. Little x plus. Little x minus there. So the way to pick out, so here the kappa is manifestly positive. So the way to pick out each of these coefficients is just to do the inverse Fourier transform with respect to the small x minus coordinate. Because if I take this function, and I multiply by e to the I kappa x little minus, and then I integrate to little x minus, from minus infinity to plus infinity, then this is going to give me a delta function here in, if I'd chosen this to be a different label, it would pick out this piece. But it won't pick out that one, because what we're doing is assuming kappa is positive, and so here you'll get a sum of exponentials, and so the delta function will never be able to be satisfied. So this will automatically pick out the alpha k kappa, some for some particular value of kappa, over root 2 kappa. I would just pick that out. Similarly, if we'd done the Fourier transform with the opposite sign, pardon? Sorry, I beg your pardon. Thanks. Similarly, if we do the transform the other way around, gx minus, we get beta. And now let me remind you that x minus was minus 1 over a e to the minus a x minus, little x minus. That was the transformation. So these exponentials here are just equivalent to e to the plus I k over a e to the minus a x minus, an exponential of an oscillating exponential, or an oscillating exponential of an exponential. So these are pretty horrendous integrals to do. You can do them, but I'm not going to do them, because we're going to use a trick instead. And the trick is as follows. Is there any questions about how I got to that point?
So Fourier transforming to extract the
coefficients. To extract the coefficients, yeah. Just using the fact that for Fourier transform this, I get a delta function, but this will give me zero if I choose the sign appropriately. Because we're choosing k and kappa to be positive. So the trick to doing the integral is to deform the contour. So the key point is that this thing is a wildly oscillating. This is incredibly oscillating with an exponential factor. So whenever you have an oscillating integral, it's usually poorly defined. And what we have to do is define it by analytical. Yeah.
X with the minus up.
Sorry.
What's x with the minus above instead of below?
Oh, I beg your pardon. I was not distinguishing up and down. I should have been more careful with that. I wasn't using. So for me, x minus is always the same thing.
Okay. The thing, like if you just compare the exponentials of the e to the ik x minus and the thing that's supposed to be equal to it, it seems as though that x minus is equal to something e to the I e to the negative a x minus.
One's a big x, one's a little x.
Oh, okay.
These are two things, two different things.
Okay.
That's a big x here. So that big X is the thing that's the exponential of the little x. So the big X is the light cone coordinate in the global system, and the little x is the light cone coordinate in the accelerated observer's system.
And why did we end up with big X here? Because we had little x before, and we were just Fourier transform.
No, we had, on the left-hand side, we were writing the big X modes in terms of the little ones. That's the map we're doing. So when you have an oscillatory integral, you have to to make sense of it, you always have to deform the contour into the complex plane in some way or another, so that it makes it convergent in the complex plane, and you define the oscillatory value as the value, the asymptotic value along the real axis from its convergent quantity in the complex plane. And the way we're going to make this convergent is to turn this exponential into something that falls off. So now e to the minus ax minus, this is a quantity whose smallest value can be zero, but whose largest value can be plus infinity, because when x minus goes to minus infinity, the exponent goes to plus infinity, so the exponential goes to plus infinity. So basically, we want to get rid of that plus sign, make it minus 1, so that this truly converges when this quantity goes to infinity. And we could do that very simply by just doing the following shift. X minus goes to x minus minus I pi over 2a. So we're shifting our integration contour in the imaginary direction by an imaginary shift. So instead of integrating along the real axis, we're actually going to do the integral at some point along the imaginary axis to make it convergent. And under that shift, e to the minus a x minus goes to e to the minus a x minus e to the plus I pi over 2. And e to the plus I pi over 2, of course, is just I itself. So that's I e to the minus a x minus. So that shift is exactly the shift you need to do to pick an extra factor of I in there. And that I multiplies that and gives it a minus 1. So after we've done that shift, those two formula look as follows. So this piece, as we've said, just becomes now something that converges, e to the minus k over a e to the minus ax minus dx minus, because of the extra I. We have the exponential piece. But this piece shifts under that transformation. So it picks up an e. So you'd have had an I times a minus I. So you get a plus pi kappa over 2a. And then there was 1 over root 2k. And then similarly, the formula for beta is the same integral of a little x minus. This looks exactly the same. This has the opposite sign, and therefore this piece comes out with the opposite sign. Any questions about that? Yeah.
So shouldn't we really be putting this bit of parameter on what you should x minus by so that we can let that parameter go to zero and recover its limit as we approach the real axis for our x minus?
Yeah, we should do if we were doing it really properly, but we're not. We're going to do. To do the full thing is going to be way too complicated. So we're doing. So essentially, as long as there's no contribution, there's no pole inside, and there's no contribution at infinity, which there won't be, then I can essentially deform this contour to here without any worry. Of course, I should check that there's no contribution inside here, but there won't be. So yeah, when physicists do this, they'll just do the naive thing and shift it like that and hope it works. So now it should be obvious from these formulas that the only difference between this one and this one is that this is the complex conjugate of that, and then this factor has got the different sign to that. So in other words, alpha k kappa, it differs by the fact that it's going to have two factors of pi kappa over 2a different times beta k kappa complex conjugate. And from that, so rewriting that slightly, that tells us that mod alpha k kappa squared on mod b k kappa squared is going to be e to the 2 lots of pi kappa over a, because when we take the mod squared, the fact that this is star and that isn't doesn't make any difference because it cancels out. And that's enough to get us what we wanted, because if we remember in the cases where alpha k prime was just a delta function, so where we just had alpha k, then the normalization conditions for the Bogoliubov coefficients was something like this. In the general case, it looks like alpha k1 kappa mod squared minus, sorry, let me be more careful. It looks like alpha k1 kappa alpha star k2 kappa minus beta k1 kappa beta star k2 kappa integrated to kappa over 2 pi is then a delta function 2 pi delta k1 minus k2. Did I do that the right way? I wanted to say it the other way, didn't I? Sorry, I wanted to say it. I wanted to say it the other way around. So by the same token, kappa 1 k alpha star, kappa 2 k minus beta, kappa 1 k, beta star, kappa 2 k is 2 pi times the delta function in kappas. So those are the equivalent of the unitarity conditions in the general case. And so looking at this formula, when kappa 1 is kappa 2, this is integral to k over 2 pi mod alpha k kappa squared minus mod beta k kappa squared is 2 pi times the delta function at the origin in k space. But the correct way to interpret the delta function in origin is used the fact that so delta k is integral over real space e to the I k x. When we set k equals 0, then this just gives you have to compactify the space, take the space to be compact, and so this is just 2 pi times the size at the space. So it was the same trick we used before to say that the total number of particles scaled with the volume, so we have to make the volume finite to get a finite number. Is everyone happy with that? Yeah?
I'm curious about this factor, the ratio of alpha over beta. Is the alpha by alpha squared over beta squared, does that hold for regardless of what parameter we had put in doing this?
So which parameter are you thinking of exactly?
I'm thinking of what I was talking about earlier, where you have to actually take the limit as you go back to the original integral. And I'm wondering, does that factor go to e to the 0, which is just 1 again? Or does it stay like that?
It stays like that. So you get that factor just as a fact of having to go into the imaginary axis, but you'll get it. It'll remain in the limit. So if we did it really properly, we would have defined this as some boundary value of some well-defined function in the complex plane, and you would still get that factor. I know it seems a little bit dodgy like this, but it does work out right. So now the key point is, because we know this formula, we can rewrite this like that, minus 1 mod beta k kappa squared is equal to the size of the space, or in general this is the volume, because it's just because we're in one dimension, it's only the length, but in general that would be the volume. And so in other words, this quantity is L over e to the 2 pi kappa. And this was positive, so I'll write mod kappa in there. And I wrote mod kappa because if we'd chosen kappa to be negative, that it would come out with the same sign. So it really is the modulus when you do the full calculation. But you'll have to take my word for that. But this quantity, what is it? It's simply the number of particles per mode k. So it's the number of particles that you'll see in a given mode. Sorry, not k, kappa. So kappa, remember, is the momenta for the accelerated observer. And this is, by definition, from the standard arguments, the Bogoliubov parameter beta gives you the number of particles. So in other words, the number per unit length is precisely this factor here. And that factor should be familiar because it's precisely what you get in a thermal distribution. It's of the form e to the e over kt minus 1. It's the Bose-Einstein distribution factor, where e is mod kappa and kt is a over 2 pi. So this is the result we were after before we gave a hand-wavy argument that an accelerated observer thinks is at finite temperature, but now we see explicitly that if you rewrite the globally defined Minkowski mode functions, which are these ones, in terms of the basis functions defined in the frame of reference for an accelerated observer, then that accelerated observer, he sees particles in the vacuum state, and the number density of those particles is precisely given by a thermal distribution at a temperature which is proportional to the acceleration. And that is the Unruh effect. Yeah?
So every time this would be a consequence of the horizon.
Yes.
I really don't see that anywhere in the map.
So the reason is, so a thermal state, well, it is quite hard even to see when you know the answer, but so a thermal state is a mixed state. So you might have thought to yourself, well, this is a bit strange actually, because we started with a state that was a pure state. So a pure state is one that's defined. So if we work in the density matrix language where we take a state like this, so a pure state written as a density matrix looks like that, and it satisfies the condition that rho squared is psi 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 psi, but if this is properly normalized, that's equal to rho. So that's the property of a pure state is that as well as trace of rho being 1, trace of rho squared is also 1. But a thermal state looks like this. Its density matrix is is a thermal distribution, goes like e to the minus b to h, where h is the Hamiltonian, so if you work in an eigenbasis, this just comes to the energy. Z minus 1 here is just the normalization factor, or the partition function. So that's the density matrix for a thermal state. And so we found something slightly contradictory, because we wrote a pure state, which was the Minkowski vacuum, and what we've come out with is something that looks like a thermal state. And the physical origin of that really is to do with the presence of the horizons. So it's because you have this event horizon here, so the accelerated observer's coordinate system covers like this. So here's mode functions, which are these guys, the e to the ikx pluses. They only cover this region of the space. And so what you're doing is you're trying to write a mode function which is defined everywhere. So you're trying to write something that has functional support of the entire space-time in a set of modes which are defined only in this region. And there's some tension there. Clearly there's a problem. And in fact, going the other way, if we try to do the inverse of this transformation, if we try to write these modes as a superposition of these modes, we would have failed miserably. In fact, you just find divergences. And the reason is if you have something that's got compact support in this region, and then you try and write it in terms of these modes, you can't write it in the global basis of modes, because it was only defined in this region from the outset. And so physically what's going on is you're taking your original density matrix, which is the Minkowski density matrix, which is a pure state. But because this observer has an event horizon, he can't see what's over here, and he can't see what's over here. And when you can't see something, the right thing to do is to take the trace over, you trace out the density matrix over all the things that you can't see. Right? Because you're never going to be able to observe that. And so you get some, after you do that trace, you get some effective density matrix which describes the same state but now viewed with respect to the accelerated observer that can only see that patch. But whenever you take a pure state and you trace out degrees of freedom that you can't see, you always get a mixed state. And if you actually do that calculation in this case, that trace gives precisely e to the minus beta h.
And then, you know, next year you say that stop accelerating.
Yeah.
Then I don't. I mean, whole space is called connected, then the horizon from my past disappeared.
Right.
But I still observe the temperature, even though there's no.
So you there in that situation, you will sort of you'll see a temperature for a while, but when you stop accelerating, you eventually see the whole space and it goes away.
Yeah. So like. Technically, the event horizon doesn't actually exist because
in that case, you don't have a real. So here, I'm really assuming that you accelerate for all time, and so it's really a global. You know, event horizon is really a global concept. You know, the local concept is an apparent horizon, and you can have an apparent horizon for a period of time, and then you can, roughly speaking, associate a temperature with that. But it can go away. Whereas if you have a real event horizon, then you have a temperature. Yeah.
So this is a two-dimensional case, and there are some special things that made it really easy in 2D. Do you get the same kind of effects in actual, you know, four dimensions?
But yeah, you get exactly the. You get exactly this formula, but there's absolutely no way I could do that. It's really just harder to do. So the way you get the answer is by doing different tricks. So here is the case where you can actually explicitly rewrite. Rewrite the Minkowski mode functions in the basis, and we can actually do that transformation. In general, it would just be a nightmare. I mean, maybe it's possible, but it's going to take a long time to do. But you can get the same answer other ways. But ultimately, you know, this justifies the crappy argument of going to Euclidean time and it being periodic there.
Tracing over like by actually tracing over the state on the whole space time?
By actually doing that trace?
Right.
Yes.
Okay, and you get the same?
Yeah.
Okay, let's, if I can ask the second question. So you said that what you're doing is, so the accelerated observer can only, is only causally connected to part of the space time. So you trace over the part that she's not connected to.
Yeah.
And then you get the state for the accelerated observer. But I can't see why something, like if you label the quadrants 1, 2, 3, 4 in clockwise or counterclockwise, I can't see why things in quadrant 4 can't affect the accelerated observer.
They can affect. They can affect, but he can't send a signal back. So the, this is the region in which you can both send a signal to and get a signal back.
Why is that?
So, I mean, you're right, of course. Okay, so you could have something coming in here, but when we chose the Minkowski vacuum globally, we automatically assumed there was nothing coming in. So what we're doing is we're writing a state in which we've assumed there's nothing coming in through this surface, through the null surface there, and ask what does that look like with respect to the observer in this region.
Suppose I only traced out stuff that the observer, that is not in the past light cone of the accelerated observer. So I only traced out quadrants 2 and 3. Would I get the same answer?
This one and this one? Or
yeah.
This one and this one.
Yeah.
If you trace out only those, then so again, so okay. Now you're asking me. So in the De Sitter case, I can answer that. So actually, yeah, so I haven't got to De Sitter at all, so but I guess you can just start doing it tomorrow now. Do you want me to do it tomorrow? Okay. Okay. Well, in that case, let me stop here and then we can continue tomorrow and then we'll get to the De Sitter case. Is that okay? Okay. Yeah, let's stop there. So for once, I'm going to finish on time.